Acclaimed chef Peter Kuravita is one of Australia's favourite food educators, bringing us a range of flavours from modern Australian to Mexican to Islander cuisine. His latest venture is a new cookbook that takes readers back to his roots. In fact, on a culinary journey through seven countries in the subcontinent, including Bhutan, Iran, Afghanistan, India, and the country of his heritage, Sri Lanka. Adeline Ng asked him about his latest trip.
It's been a while since I've crossed into the Northern Hemisphere. I'm always intrigued with the Middle East because there's so much history there. And touching on Afghanistan, I guess, was a good way to bring that into it and also to start to discover again the food there. And I think if you look at a place like Iran, so many amazing food trends have come from there. Ice cream, sherbet, you know, the kulfis and saffron, and all of those filtered through to Afghanistan. So it was nice to be able to draw on those Middle Eastern flavours as well to add a little bit of spice to this, or different spice to this book.
You must have, you know, if not the best, one of the best jobs in the world, just travelling around these regions and sampling all these wonderful flavours. But I have to admit, the first question that came to my mind when I saw the title of the book was, why a vegetarian cookbook? Because all my friends who love Sri Lankan curries love their meat as well.
Oh, for sure. Look, Sri Lanka is a very diverse country when it comes to cultures and religions. And so, you know, if you were a pure Buddhist, you would not eat meat and you would be probably only eating before midday. But Buddhism is a very easygoing philosophy of life, and you can abstain on some things and take others. But a lot of the Buddhist people and a lot of the people in our family household, 22 people in our big compound, all related very closely. Half of them were probably vegetarians by choice, but they occasionally were flexitarians if they thought they needed it. And I think it's an important thing to think about, that food is not just food, it's medicine. And people who understand that, like my grandmother and my aunties, when she cooked for the health of the household, you know. So if there was a flu going around, there'd be certain things cooked. There wouldn't be any cold dishes served, and there'd be, you know, things to reduce phlegm and ginger and different vegetables. So Ayurveda, food, culture, all comes into it in a Sinhalese way. And then, you know, all the abattoirs and all the butchers in Sri Lanka are all Muslim Tamils. And then you have the Tamil Hindus and the Indian Hindus, and they don't eat beef. So it's, you can go to Sri Lanka and have very, very different food experiences, but you'll find floating through a market in Sri Lanka, there are just so many varieties of vegetables that you couldn't help but having at least six or seven of those and maybe one meat.
Yeah, you mentioned a word that is quite intriguing, and that is flexitarian. I mean, could you expand what that means? I mean, does that give some hope for those people who do love their meat with their curries?
Yeah, look, it's a real thing. It's when I started this book, this has been a long journey. It's been nearly 4 years. This book started as a Mexican cookbook and ended up changing over. And when I was thrown the question, what would you like to do? Vegetarian came up straight away, because in a restaurant you have enough requests for vegetarian and other dietaries that it's becoming very noticeable in the day-to-day operations of a restaurant. So to do a vegetarian cookbook wasn't a hard decision at all. And to get to, you know, where I was, I just wanted to do a different vegetarian cookbook, not one that, there's lots of Indian vegetarian cookbooks and there's lots of Western vegetarian cookbooks, but there's not a lot in between. And countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan and Bangladesh, who are mostly Islamic countries, they really feel that, you know, meat should be on the table every day. But the research that I started to get into, and speaking to Afghan refugees, Bhutanese refugees in Tasmania, by, you know, from all places, started to find out that, look, there is an incredible vegetarian culture around the world. And so writing it was not hard. It was just coming up with trying to decipher which recipes I wanted to put in. Like in our restaurant now at Noosa Beach House in Noosa, we have three vegetarian dishes on the menu. But the demand now is such that we actually have a vegetarian degustation. So wow. If you're a vegetarian or a vegan, you've got 11 to 12 dishes to choose from on our menu. And that's just the way we should all go. I think I don't know whether I said it, but, you know, rather than having the veggies with a big piece of meat and the veggies aside, I'm advocating that we have lots and lots of veggies and have one piece of meat as your side dish. And that's what a flexitarian is. It's a real thing. And in that research, I started looking up the categories of vegetarianism and the categories of dietary. And, you know, we've got flexitarian, ovo-lacto, all of these things. But the newest one is flexitarian, which means if I want to, my son's girlfriend has just become flexitarian because she was told that she's, you know, having to take supplements. So therefore, she has understood that maybe occasionally she can eat a little bit of chicken.
It kind of bends the mind a little bit because you'd think of, I wouldn't have thought of meat as a side dish just because of the way I've grown up with food. But at the same time, it makes perfect sense just because of the message that is getting more prevalent these days that, you know, we should all be eating a little bit less meat and that would bring a little bit more balance in our diets.
I think so. I definitely agree. And I had this brainwave a few nights ago where I sat up bolt right in bed because I tend to dream a lot about things, and if I don't write them down then I can't sleep. And thinking about this whole, I have a pen and paper by my bed all the time, so any ideas, and most of them come to me in the middle of the night, and if I just jot them down I can go back to sleep. But the idea of serving the protein as the side, I don't think has ever been done before, and that's, I just like doing things differently. And I also don't want this book to be, you know, preaching, hey, don't eat meat. It's just, I think, a sign of the times, and that if you want to, you can add meat, or if you don't want. And the Islamic countries, some of them, I was struggling to find pure vegetarian dishes until I dug deeper and realized that all the things that the meat gets put on is delicious. So, you know, there's this beautiful Afghan okra stew, which normally should have some, you know, mutton through it. Just take the mutton out. It's just as beautiful. And so the bases, you know, you think about if you don't have meat in a kebab, you can have a falafel and it's just as good. And we're used to that. So it's just about changing the way you think and how vegetables are. I mean, I think pulses to me are really important. Obviously, to some people and some diet, people say you shouldn't eat pulses or grains either, but I don't know whether a Sri Lankan could actually continue through their life's journey at least twice a week.
I understand what you mean. I have an Indian husband, so.
Yeah, that'd just be, you know, like taking away your wife and children in your house.
Yeah, that's right. Must have dal.
Exactly.
Is the one uniting ingredient in all these countries that you feature the curry leaf? Because that is the title of the book. Is that the essential?
It's not essential for everywhere. Different countries look at it in different ways. And if you look at Sri Lanka, it's in pretty much everything. It's a digestive. Bhutan, not as much because it's up in the hills, but, you know, it's connected to the subcontinent. And places like Afghanistan, I mean, the traders have gone through all of those countries. So, yes, it is the uniting spice herb plant. And to me, it's one of the most beautiful, versatile things you can use, and so unusually flavored at the moment. There's a new gin that's come up. You know how gin is just crazy at the moment. Well, there's a gin called Colombo 7 Gin, which is infused with curry leaves, which is absolutely beautiful. And when we serve a gin and tonic, we put a few fried curry leaves into it. So, you know, yes, lands of the curry leaf with a gin and tonic.
I have not heard of that combination. That is fascinating.
Stunning. It's called Colombo 7 Gin. It's beautiful.
But of course, we mentioned this is also a highly personal book for you. It is the food of your heritage and also memories from a young Peter's life. What experiences did you draw from putting this book together?
Oh, look, so many. I have to send a big thanks to my mum. She's an amazing record keeper, and she's pretty much put down our whole family's history going back a few hundred years. And a couple of years ago, she handed it to myself and my two brothers and said, right, now it's time for you to continue these stories. So she's documented our whole lives. And this expedition that really makes up the journey of this book was called Expedition Ant and Bee. It's called Bee because as we took off from London, I got stung in the eye by a bee and had a swollen eye for half of the trip, which took 6 weeks. And Ant because ants got into everything. So her recollections really helped me through some of these because I was 4 years old. But I think one of the really great personal memories I have is going through Iran and Iraq into Afghanistan, and we were running low on water. My father was a pretty resourceful guy and could speak to anyone in any language with his hands and feet and gestures. So he was very outgoing and happy to deal with lots of people. And these Bedouins trotted along. And I really remember this clearly. It's a vivid memory of mine. And we got on their camels, my dad and I, and they took us to this place in the middle of the sand, and they just pointed to a hole. And in the hole, it was deep, and there was water flowing through the hole. So Dad tried to reach it, and he couldn't reach it. So he grabbed me by my legs, my four-year-old legs, and lowered me with a bucket into this hole. And then I scooped the water up, and he lifted me like pulling a bucket out of a well, and we filled the water up and did it again. So that's a really vivid memory. I think another one of that journey would be, you know, being in the desert again and all of our Easter eggs melting, and because my auntie in Austria had given them to us for Easter. But when Easter came around, I think we were stuck in the desert in Pakistan or somewhere, and they were all runny. And then on top of that, you know, your family stories become your own as well, because you've heard them so many times. And the bread section is really special to me, because Mum really wrote a lot about the breads and how these kids were selling breads like rope strung over their arm in Afghanistan. And then, you know, as we went through the different areas, how the bread changed and how nutritious and nourishing it was. Or, you know, coming to a river and finding a caravan of camels that were taking watermelons from one desert town to another, you know, and us sitting there by the river and opening one up and eating it. And food has always revolved around it. I mean, Dad and Mum cooked three curries a day out of the back of that van, and we scavenged whatever we needed to, and Mum had a little pantry going there. And so it was always about food and travel. And I think that's what's really driven me all my life, is the quest to discover what they did and also then discover new things. In my office here, I've got a map of the world, and it's just covered in dots. And I've managed to now finally put a couple of dots on Africa, because I just came back from South Africa. So the only other big place I have to go to now is South America, and then I think I've done them all. So, and it's a never-ending quest. I've never been to Norway, and I intend to go. I'd love to see Greenland. And I think these days people travel to where there's good food. There's a few exceptions, but part of our sensory experience these days is food.
And there's some places where you have unfinished business as well, don't you? Because I understand from your book that you have an intention, if it's possible, to go back to Afghanistan.
Oh, I'd love to. Look, I bought a motorcycle, the one that they used to use for the Paris-Dakar years ago. I don't like riding on the road. And so I ended up selling it with only a few thousand kilometres on it after I'd had it for 5 years. But my plan had always been to go to try and repeat that journey, but from Australia. So cross over into New Guinea and then up through Asia and then try and cut across. But that Middle East crossing these days is quite hard. I mean, I could do it again if we were keen. We've still got a 12-year-old kid. So maybe when he's grown up, we could go the other way, which would be through, you know, Kazakhstan and up through the northern countries through Russia. But unfortunately, Afghanistan and those places are a little bit out of reach now. It's a shame, and I hope one day that changes. But, yeah, I wouldn't risk myself or my family going through there at the moment.
Do you think we do subcontinent food well in Australia?
I think we do all food well in Australia. I think we're really lucky here. We have a lot of first and second generation people here who brought their foods over. And it's an interesting question, because I travel a lot, as we've just talked about, and I go to countries which have been colonized or have had people imported into them. And when I say that, it's a lot of Indians. Say South Africa is one. I don't know whether you've ever seen or heard of anything called bunny chow. That's one of the most interesting hybrid Indian dishes I've ever seen in my life. It's a giant bread roll which is hollowed out, and then they stick a whole lamb shank curry in the center of it.
Okay. No, so I've not seen that one.
Right. So what state of India is that from? Not, you know, but it's Indian. And then Fiji is another one where people have traveled and their food has changed a lot. Like a Fijian chicken curry or any Fijian curry does not relate to any curry in India. But Australia is lucky. I mean, I think you get the best Cantonese food in the world in Sydney's Chinatown. The food is so authentic Cantonese. I mean, it's changed a lot in China itself due to availability of produce. So we are lucky enough to have all of these people, first-generation people who came here. The Italians and the Greeks, you know, taught Australia how to eat nice food and to eat vegetables and all of those kind of things. So, yes, that was a long answer. The short answer is 100% Australia does most cultures' foods excellently.
That's very reassuring to know. Now, can you leave us with any tips for cooking with spices? Because there are tricks to getting, you know, certain flavours and textures out, is what I've heard.
Plenty. Look, I think the first thing is, please just buy small amounts, keep them in airtight containers in the dark. I always tell people that, and people nod their head, so I believe it's true that most people have spices in their cupboard that are at least as old as their youngest child. You know, and that's just no good. After 6 months, you're not going to get that vibrant flavor. You're better off buying the seeds, which will keep longer, and then roasting and grinding yourself. But of course, we're time poor. But if you do, this is a book about discovery, and it's something that I really want people to make their own. And in this book, there are so many hints. I mean, here's one. I would say so many people are buying cassia instead of cinnamon because it's cheaper. Cassia is really different. It's a similar plant, and it has cassian in it, but it's a totally different flavor. And I travel around the world a lot to hotels, and every single hotel has cassia, not cinnamon. So I've got a bit in there talking about cinnamon. I've made photos of all the spices so that people can actually see it, visually see what the spices should look like. And there's a deep and detailed explanation about what you should expect. So the spices section there is really will give you an education. It's my sermon to people about spices. And once you've got that, look, to fill your pantry with everything to cook from seven countries of the subcontinent, you're going to need a large pantry. So my suggestion is start with some of the basics, get into your recipes, and slowly your pantry will build. And as you have nowadays access to, you know, home vac machines, once you've made your spice mix, vac it, put it in the fridge. It'll last a lot longer.
I am taking notes, and there's plenty more in your book, which I'm so appreciative of, because it's like a mini encyclopedia through the land. So it doesn't take a lot of time to read, but it's a great introduction to how the different countries within the subcontinent that you feature are how they're unique. So it's a fabulous book, and I think a great addition to any kitchen. I think a must have. So I think you've done really well, Peter. I just can't wait to see what you're up to next.
Great. Well, thanks a lot. And you can message me back and tell me what your Indian husband thinks, because the people from the subcontinent will be the biggest critics of all. As usual. So I've tried to make every recipe my own, okay? So everyone out there from the subcontinent, this is my version. Take my book, take it home, and then make it yours. Make the book dirty, get some turmeric on it, and, you know, put your family's history into my book. And I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you so much, Peter, for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Adelaine Ng speaking there with Peter Kuravita, whose new book, Lands of the Curry Leaf, is published by Murdoch Books. Peter will also be sharing two of his recipes from the book on our Facebook page in coming days. You're listening to the Travel Writers Show on JAIR 87.8 FM.